Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius, Nick Green calls on a turf manager, an expert on color theory, and a landscape historian to understand the field itself, a paleoanthropologist to talk kicking, and an Anglican priest to explain schisms, how American football, soccer, and rugby could all develop from the field games of rowdy 19th century British schoolboys. Green delves deep into what defines the game, how it developed, and what happens during a match's 90 minutes and then some. His expert commentators included Domino Toppler, a developmental neuroscientist, an art historian, a civil engineer, and more. Nick Green is author previously of How to Watch Basketball Like a Genius. His work has appeared in the Slate, Washington Post, Chicago Magazine. He's covered everything from the NBA to NFL analysis to quirky lifestyle experiments, such as riding the entire New York subway in one day and negotiating his internet bill using Sun Tzu's The Art of War. And Nick Green joins us on the program today. Nick Green, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius this time around, previously basketball. This is very well timed, of course. The World Cup coming to North America this summer.
Yeah, would you look at that? It worked out pretty well.
You say that your steadiest attraction to any sport has been soccer. You always come back to soccer.
Yeah, I always come back to soccer. You know, I've been a big soccer fan for 25 years or so, and I might have been following other sports longer, but I feel like I've stayed steadiest and truest to soccer, or soccer stayed steadiest and truest to me. I don't know which way it goes.
Mm-hmm. You write, on the surface, soccer seems like the simplest of games. One ball, two teams, two goals, preferably some grass. There's a reason it's the first team sport. Little kids learn to play, but the closer you look, the more you dig into the game's history, the more infinitely complex and complex the picture becomes. So we'll get into that. So what are you trying to accomplish here? You humorously write that you're not trying to teach people how to play soccer. You rode the bench in school.
I know. I still do in my adult league made of decrepit old men. So that's consistent as well. This is sort of my effort to understand what we're looking at when we watch soccer, to sort of really try to, maybe in a way that isn't obvious at first, but will help us expand our appreciation for the game. And that includes learning its history, its evolution, and then also, I guess, some other little sort of fun detours along the way. But my goal with this book really is just to give a well-rounded, I guess, not just sort of survey of the game itself, but a survey on how we watch it and why we watch it the way we do.
You say some of the best tour guides on this journey are ones who've never bothered to learn the normal rules in the first place, experts from seemingly unrelated fields. The subtitle of the book, What Architects, Stunt Women, Paleoanthropologists, Computer Scientists Revealed About the World's Game. We'll get into that's kind of a nice twist here. First of all, kind of a broad question. Why do you think this is the world's game? Is it, I guess, simplicity of...
So the simplicity helps. I mean, that's a huge reason why soccer is so ubiquitous and so popular. Low barrier for entry, cheap. If you played anywhere, as I mentioned, you just need a ball. Don't even need a ball. I mean, a lot of players, I think Pele famously learned to play with, I think it was bundled trash, although that might be sort of a romantic story. But it's a low barrier for entry. It's cheap. You don't even need the goals. You can put two book bags to make a goal, which I did with my friends. But a major reason is it just happened to be codified at a certain time in history when mass media, things like mass gatherings, ticketed performances, were becoming a huge fad. This was the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s in England, where the rules that we, the game that we know is played with were codified and put into place. So it happened to just be, it's both simplicity, ease of dispersion, I guess, and also right place, right time.
You're right, it's simultaneously the most ubiquitous sport of the 21st century and a wildly outmoded enterprise. The game could never be invented today. You say that's a good thing. For example, No TV timeouts.
No TV timeouts, no breaks in play except for halftime. I mean, if you were making a game today, the first thing you would do is say, okay, when can we put the commercials? When can we make a little bit of money for ourselves? You know, when do we give the advertisers their stage? But soccer is completely dedicated to the game and the players itself. And the fact that it hasn't bucked that, hasn't relented it, is very admirable and shows that, you know, it's a very resilient game. It's I think I describe it like a piece of geology. Things seem to move around it rather than the other way around.
You say Americans are blessed with a unique perspective of the sport. We usually like things that revolve totally around us. We recognize that this is not one of those things, but yet it exists. It's very popular in the world.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, I you know, people who are would consider themselves, I guess, the sport's more blue-blooded followers. People in other countries have a perception of American fans, but I do think that we are, as I said, blessed because we get to look at it as a unique phenomenon, something that is outside, as I said, outside our bounds of control, and which is usually something we kind of, I'm generalizing here, and I know it's a huge generalization, but again, something that we concede as being a huge deal, yet is not something that we are either the best at or in direct control of. I think that helps us maybe appreciate some nuances of it and be more critical about others, you know, but that's just my sort of own experience in talking with peers and other and strangers about the sport, which I love to do.
And yet we, you know, we want to be the best at everything. I mean, the national team is improving over time.
Sure.
Not one of the favorites, I wouldn't think, in the World Cup. The national coach, Argentinian, Mauricio Pochettino recently said, I can't remember his quote exactly. He said it's not in the blood, in the culture, uh-huh. Right? The way it is in Argentina. he was lamenting that.
You know, I think it's getting there more and more. And also, you have to sort of give ourselves some grace. It's really hard to win a World Cup. Not many teams, not many countries have done it. A lot of luck is involved. In the book, I speak at length with a astronomer and a former NASA scientist who went so far as to do a peer-reviewed study that was published in a, you know, brilliant, very well-respected journal, that essentially came to the conclusion via evidence that the winner of the World Cup is usually pretty random. The result is random. There's so, you know, soccer matches have few goals. World Cups have relatively few games. Therefore, the best team, do they always win? No. A lot of luck is involved. It's not an exact sport. It's probably our least exact sport. So no matter what happens with Team USA this summer, luck is going to have a huge, huge hand in that.
This would be a good time. You just mentioned that to bring in this. You talked with a scientist who he said soccer games are poorly designed experiments.
Yes.
It's low scoring, right? So that enables a lot of noise to be involved. Random events can really affect it.
Exactly. And he likened it to, he was designing telescopes to find things like evidence of quasars in, you know, from distant galaxies and beyond. So he says he's used to looking for data in periods and fields where there isn't much data. And that's like a soccer match where you have 90 minutes, a lot goes on, and you could still have a 1-0, you know, 1-1, 0-0 result. And he, I think, very almost poetically described them as matches as poorly designed experiments. Granted, he's coming at it from somewhere where the experiment is who wins and who's better. Some people who watch soccer don't necessarily watch just for that. You know, there's a lot of nuance to it. Maybe that's again, overly romantic way to look at it, but it's one of the many ways you can watch this, again, seemingly simple game.
So that there's a stat called expected goals, right?
And yes.
Soccer fans know your team might have had by far the better match, and you could end up in a 0-0 tie or something.
Yeah, it's a fascinating metric that sort of basically gives puts a you know explains okay who was creating who had who not necessarily who was playing better, but who was creating chances that, given historical data, represent more likely chance of scoring. And it's a way to sort of view the game as a what could have been rather than what actually was. It would be like having a stat for football saying, okay, the New York Giants actually should have won 34-7, but they lost 17-10, and have a relatively sound empirical framework to that stat. Again, it's 1 point. It's sort of how the game feels versus how it actually ended.
Well, especially so in soccer, I think it's that can lead to some frustration, I'm sure. It leads to that kind of that culture. So I guess this you have a whole section on superstitions, which especially prevalent in soccer, I guess, because of that random nature of the outcome of the game.
Oh, how, I mean, yeah, I mean, how it is rife for superstition, and it's so frustrating, and that's part of it. I mean, that's the whole point of the game is you watch and your team is battering the other team, and you lose 1-0. I mean, there's so much I think we as viewers and fans can learn from that. It's a every game is a valuable lesson in how to sort of seed yourself to some greater event outside of yourself and the event itself, in a way. Yeah, but the superstition, there's anytime someone misses a penalty on a big stage, a high stakes penalty, there's bound to be explanations varying in, I guess their basis in reality. When Roberto Baggio missed the penalty in the final, the World Cup final in '94, fans in Brazil said that Senna, the famous race car driver who died earlier in the year, had guided the ball over the bar and kind of given Brazil the title. It's just a natural sort of way to explain such an inexact and random game.
There was one instance, I can't remember which match, a really big match. One of the teams had a magician come in, put a crystals behind the goal to
Yeah,
repel the ball.
that was the famous mentalist Uri Geller, I believe his name is, and I talk about it. This was, I think, in the early 2000s. He's the guy who bends spoons with his mind. And Exeter City, I believe, it's in the book. I have to check. He had a small stake in one of the teams, I think, in the lower divisions in England. And the last game of the season, they could have gotten relegated, depending on the results. And he put some sort of energy crystals behind the goals. I don't know if that was to attract goals or to repel them. It didn't work because Exeter City lost the game. I think it's Exeter City. I might be wrong, so forgive me if I am. But his team lost. However, results elsewhere in the division went their way, and so they lost but did not get relegated, thus raising the question, did those energy crystals work? Well, maybe not in the way they were intended, but yeah, they did, I guess.
I think another product of this kind of the high stakes and the randomness here is the flopping. I'm kind of going out of order here. We'll get back into the history a little later.
No, yeah, no
But
order. It's all good.
soccer's famous for flopping. I should say basketball. We got the NBA playoffs going on right now. I've been watching games and seeing some beautiful flops, some very artistic flops. But soccer, especially known for it. You talk with a stunt woman.
Yes.
To talk about flops. Tell me about that.
I came sort of to the realization and the conclusion that you can get mad at flopping all you want, and many people do. I'd say almost most fans do. But it's a hard thing to eradicate. It's gonna happen one way or another. So I sort of went the other way, and I tried to appreciate flopping, both as a performance art, and just, I guess the pure physicality and sort of verve behind a flop. So I talked to a stunt woman and had her watch with me and rate some of Luis Suarez, who is a prolific diver, some of his best dives and flops. And she gave some pretty interesting insight to that. And she pointed out, it's not easy to fake a fall. You're still falling. And she was especially watching his wrists and his hands, because I guess stunt people are always at danger of breaking their wrist, and they always have to understand how to make it look like a natural fall, which was involved you putting your hand down and breaking your fall, but not doing so in a way that actually puts yourself in danger. So I had a really fun conversation with her, and she told me about that, and she also told me about how to get hit by a car, which is something she does in her line of work. So it was a very broad, wide-ranging interview.
That would be even a higher stakes skill, right?
Yeah, that she said that doesn't involve flopping. You actually do get hit by the car. So
You do, wow, but you don't
yeah.
try not to get hurt in that,
I think you jump a little bit in the air and
yeah.
then you take the impact and you learn how to fall. But it's she said it's something she's trying to segue out of in her career. Fewer car hits.
I want to just read this portion again on flopping. You say preserving the open nature of the free-flowing nature of the game, in essence, the primary responsibility of the referee. They must interpret the actions of the would-be artists, talking about floppers, in real time, and help conduct the rhythm of the two parties directly at odds with each other. It's a terribly difficult job. The best possible scenario after it's completed is that thousands of people won't be driven to a murderous rage.
Yes.
A diver takes advantage of the referee's fidelity to the free and open play by pantomiming the supposed undoing. But nobody ever pities the ref. It's a very tough job,
I have
refereeing.
tons of empathy for referees. And I may be one of the only people in the world who does, but I feel like it's an extremely hard job. In soccer, where it's an expansive, huge pitch and the players are very spread out. I mean, in football, there are the action is relatively contained to certain parts of the field, and you have other eyes on the field. There are other judges. I mean, in soccer, the assistant referees, but the main referee in soccer has to cover a stupendous amount of ground with 22 very spread out players. And they have to do this as it's happening fast, and their sight lines might not be perfect. And they have to interpret things like whether to play on, if there's advantage for the attacking team. It's an incredibly hard job, and their job is not just basically to sort of permit fairness, but to also manufacture a watchable and entertaining product as well. So pity and empathy to the ref. But I think that's no matter what I say, it's not going to stop. As I said, the best possible scenario for a referee is that thousands of people don't want to kill you. So I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
So one more thing on flopping is the stereotype that a lot of people, Americans, have, and others, I imagine, the flopper. I would think the flopper would maintain at least illusion of injury for a little longer, right? Get the spectacular flop, the referee rules against him, and then he gets up and sprints off the field.
Yeah. No, I almost admire the elite floppers who can do that. They don't have that sort of shame. And it's in a way, you look at it again, oh, it's shameless, but also, hey, all they want to do is win. Wouldn't you do as much as you can to win? Wouldn't you do as much as possible to win? Especially when there's things like money on the line. I spoke with an ethicist and philosopher about this. And it's something that you'd expect to have to hear. There's a very sort of defined right versus wrong, but he says it's blurrier than that. I mean, granted, he's a Real Madrid fan, I think, so he his perception has been skewed. But really, I mean, there's also a bit about the Women's World Cup, and it is there's scientific studies that have found that female soccer players do dive less frequently than their male counterparts. But a Washington Post columnist, she brought up a good point, and some of the players and coaching staffs of recent Women's World Cup teams sort of back this up, is that now that that sport is the women's game is on such a, it's a huge stage, and there's lots of money involved, and the stakes are that much higher, you start to see players dive more. There's almost like this sense of less about the integrity of the game and more about winning at all costs. And I thought that's an interesting development of when you introduce higher stakes, more money, even things like sponsorship deals, that the your approach to the fidelity of the game and the sort of honor fades a little bit. I think that's something that can be expanded and expounded upon in other walks of life too, dare I say.
Yeah, certainly. Purists would, I'm sure, decry this, right? They say that some purists say, well, the outcome is not really the point; it's the beauty of the flow of the game.
Yeah, I don't think it matters one way or another if I decry it. It's going to happen no matter what. And I think this book with this subject and all the others is sort of like, I want to get as well-rounded an appreciation for it. If I can't stop diving, and if it's going to happen no matter what, I might as well appreciate what these people are doing.
Let's take a break. We're talking with Nick Green. His latest book is How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius. Very well timed. The World Cup's coming to North America this summer. And we'll talk more about this following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Nick Green. His latest book is called How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius. So he talks to some various experts in seemingly unrelated fields. For example, we'll get into the history of soccer next. Paleoanthropologists talk about kicking. Tell me about this.
I can't get around the fact that a game played primarily with your feet is odd. And it's the one sort of the not being allowed to use your hands is the defining characteristic of soccer. And sort of what's the point of legislating to the feet? Well, it makes the game more challenging. It makes something that's very simple. Two goals, one ball. It requires a lot of skill, teamwork, et cetera. And so I wanted to learn more about feet. And so I found this gentleman in South Africa who began his career as a podiatrist. He still is a podiatrist, and then sort of fell backwards into becoming a paleoanthropologist. One thing led to another, and now he sort of oversees the largest collection of fossilized human remains, I guess, in the world to chart the evolution. I wanted to see why our feet are the way they are, if they're, if they're evolved to kick and be deft, and what sort of that means for the game. And he told me that no, our feet are not designed to really kick. They're designed to help us walk and stand and run and climb. That kicking is a sort of unnatural movement, that sort of controlling things with our feet. Is something we actually evolved out of the ability to do. He sort of, I guess, increased my appreciation and awe, the sense of awe I feel in watching these players, corral a ball kick 60 yards in the air with their instep and have it just sort of sit there like it was glued there. And it made me realize that this game is difficult for a lot of reasons, but primarily because it's designed to be played with a part of our bodies that hides in shoes all day and doesn't really get the chance to do the fun things that our hands get to do.
It's an impressive skill. I lived in Argentina for a while, religious mission. One point, we took on some 8-year-olds, little kids, right? And they kicked our butts. It was because
I know.
we didn't know how to dribble, and they knew how to dribble with their feet, right?
It is an insanely hard game. It's exhausting. Just the amount of running alone is pretty daunting. And there's, you know, it's not just the running, it's you're walking, you're sprinting, you're jogging, you're sprinting, you're jogging, you're running. I mean, there's been countless studies into just show just that, not only is this it's one of the more exhausting and intensive ways to do cardiovascular exercise, and you combine that with trying to do all that while you know, doing tricks and using your feet to sort of express yourself and unlock the defenses. It's a bizarre, it is at its heart, it's a bizarre game. And the fact that it's the most popular sport in the world is worth kind of pausing and reminding ourselves that the most popular sport in the world is a very weird game where you can only use your feet.
You're right. Soccer is less an invention than some side effect of the human condition. What do you mean there?
Well, there have been kicking games forever. And it's sort of and before I said it's only used with, you can only use your feet. That's not true. You can use any part of your body except your hands, but that alone is odd. But there have been kicking games forever. And it's sort of seems to be something that humans do, be it absentmindedly. When there's something at our feet, we kick it around. And the game has sort of evolved from those pastimes of absentmindedness and kind of brutal folk games of kicking a ball through a town, kicking out everyone who gets in your way to. Those over time evolved into what became soccer. And it's, you know, it's again, it was never basketball, for example. My last book was on basketball. That was, we can trace the day James Naismith sat down and wrote the rules down and invented it. It was a very concerted, sort of purposeful thing where soccer has just sort of arrived in our laps, and been embraced in a way that I think is so profoundly ubiquitous that again, it doesn't seem like something that we invented to do. It seems like something that we just sort of, there's grains of it inside of us that come out one way or another.
So you talk about medieval England's folk football, involving a sheep's inflated bladder or a decapitated head. That sounds quite the thing.
No, and that wasn't even the most brutal and violent thing about it. I mean, these guys were killing each other. I mean, these were serfs and peasants and people who spent most of their life, their agrarian life, toiling. And they'd, you know, have brief intermittent bouts of leisure and rest during these sort of these holidays like Shrovetide. And they would play these massive games with hundreds of participants. And the goals would be a gate at one end of the town and another gate at the other end of town. And they would be just basically beating the tar out of each other to get the ball from one side of town to the other, kicking each other in the shins and the legs and the heads. And these are the very games that over time sort of became what we now know and love as soccer.
Tell me a bit about how what we know today as rugby, American football, and soccer diverged. You even talk with an Anglican priest to explain schisms. How did these diverge?
Well, it all happened in 1863. The Football Association was a group of sort of young professionals in London who had either gone to the nice private schools where these games were being played, because these private schools, you know, the Eatons, the Harrows, the Rugbys, they were very wealthy and they had private land, so they had room for people to play these games on. And these gentlemen were graduating and wanted to, you know, play these games some more. And each school had a different kind of game, different rules. They had to sort of codify the one set of rules that everyone in London would play. And a lot of the guys from rugby school, which was a school, played one certain kind of way that was a little more rough and involved handling. And there were a group of guys who played, at versions that didn't involve handling and were less sort of centered around tackling and direct physical confrontation. And it actually, the one sticking point was there was a rule that there's no hacking allowed. Hacking was sort of purposefully kicking another opponent's legs to stop them. And those who played rugby said, no, we like that style. Those who played, the other form said it's too rough. It impedes the flow of the game. And so they split then and there. It's funny because hacking is no longer allowed in rugby either. So the sort of reason why the two games split doesn't even it's not even applicable today because neither sport allows that. But and going to a Anglican reverend to talk about it, I was just interested in how a sort of British invention gets popular worldwide and spreads so effectively, and talked to him a bunch about the beginning of the Anglican Church. And just like in the split between soccer and rugby, the reason why something splits, doesn't necessarily always have to be the biggest or even lasting reason two things remain separate. Oftentimes it's just a cataclysm, a cataclysm. It's an event that sparks the change, and the actual differences that may have been lurking there before start to define themselves as they evolve in separate paths.
This is where we get the word soccer, right? This split. I would have never guessed that soccer came from association.
Yes, and it's one of it's kind of maligned as a American term, and I know Europeans and will turn their noses up at it, but it's one of the most British terms you could ever think of. It was invented at Oxford, and they used to put ER at the end of names as like a jocular sort of nickname. So rugby football became Rugger, and association football, as it was known, they took the sosh, this part of association, put an ER, and that became soccer. And so it's a very sort of British nickname that we as Americans have successfully co-opted.
Yeah, that's amazing to learn that. And you say you're fine with soccer, right? Soccer or football, either way.
Soccer or football, I think they're both great terms. And I was surprised, and it was nice to know how infrequently it ever came up that I would get confused talking about football versus soccer, American football versus football. Usually in these conversations, the context is key and enough. And I think it's because of that, it should be anyone can say anything they want to call it football, soccer, it's all good.
You say that the world's game is largely accidental by design. It became codified, I guess, in the 19th century. Tell me some of the key things there. One thing I think that's of consternation to at least people who like American football is the offsides rule. That's the whole point of American football is to get behind the defense. That's the that's
Sure.
that's that's the skill. But there's an offside rule in soccer.
Yeah, and that is it's a simple rule that had to be invented to prevent cherry picking. So much of American football, the line of scrimmage, things that evolved from rugby, the creation of space was a huge issue for American football as it was developing. And I found all this evidence in early newspaper articles written in the 1800s of early American football players watching soccer, a rare sort of exhibitions that come to the States and saying, wow, they marvel at how freely space is being created. And that's largely because of the offside rule. It's a way to prevent cherry picking. It's a way to sort of, and the fact that it's defined by the players themselves, the usually the last outfield player, how far back they are. The rule itself, the language is very complicated, but once you understand it, it makes perfect sense. And the fact that the players themselves can dictate how large or small their half of the pitch can be for the opponents is pretty elegant. And the rule had been baked in for years, again, just to prevent cherry picking. And things like the offside trap, that was invented purely by accident. There was a game between England and Scotland, and this was before substitutions were allowed. And one of the English players had to go off injured, and he played in attack, I believe. And usually, they would send a or he played defense, but my apologies. And so usually what you do is you take someone who, okay, a defender left the field, let's put another defender or put a defender, a attacking player back more so they can help out with defense. Well, they just said, why don't we just move everybody up? In doing that, they accidentally created this offside trap. And it took decades to figure out how to prevent that from breaking the game because it was so effective. And other teams were became teams became so good at luring people into offsides that in the 30s the game became so stilted they had to change the rule to have it be two outfield players. Again, more language, make it more complicated. Long story short, the offside rule was relatively fixed, and even though it may be annoying and kind of confusing at certain times, it does it's a genius little fix for an inherent problem with all field games, which is the creation and facilitation of space.
Well, I'll invite you next to wax lyrical about the game. It's called the Beautiful Game, right? What makes people call it that who really appreciate it?
Gosh, I think it's the beautiful game because it's not all beautiful. It's some aspects of it are objectively beautiful. I think the field of play is beautiful. All that grass with so little markings on it, so few markings on it, is a wonderful sort of just picture, pastoral picture. I mean, I talked to my entire first chapter is about the grass. I'm obsessed with it. I think it's what made me fall in love with the game in the first place is a huge expanse of green that you get to watch for 45 minutes at a time without interruption. I mean, that's I'm a city kid. I never got that. That was so nice to be able to. That was the closest thing I ever got to nature was watching soccer on TV. But then again, you have this simple game that is basically everything is determined by the skill, the guile, and the cunning of the players themselves. It's all it's basically it's fluid, it's open. There are, it has, it's not perfect, as we talked about. There are too few goals to make it an accurate representation of which team is the, whether or not the better team wins. There's diving. There are lulls. It's not nonstop thrills. I mean, I think any soccer fan will tell you that, but that just makes the moments of genius, of grace, of suspense all the more pronounced. Because you have this sort of, you have these islands of intense action in a larger sort of field of two teams feeling each other out and trying to solve this the problem of getting the ball in the goal. It's simple but complex, but it's exciting and also sometimes, as I said, I wouldn't call it boring, but it's definitely rhythmic in a way that I think can be unique to sports in general. Yeah, I don't know. I just love it. I love the thing.
That's great. There are national flavors to how national teams play the game. Argentinians, Uruguayans, Brazilian, South American style, right? You've got
Yes.
Italians were always known as defense, stiff defense, right? Their national team's fallen apart recently, but
Yes.
the Dutch flair, right? Johan Cruyff. Tell me a little bit
Total
about that.
football. Yeah, he's almost this sort of philosopher king of the game. He Johan Cruyff, he's a Dutch player who played in the 70s and became a manager at Barcelona, and his sort of him and his manager devised at Ajax in Amsterdam, devised a way of playing they called total football. And it wasn't just them. I mean, teams, the great Austrian teams decades before, Hungarian teams in the 50s, the golden generation played like this, which is sort of positional interchangeability, that you don't have your own, you don't stay where you're basically supposed to on the pitch. You can sort of roam, trusting that your teammate will fill in for you. And it's very pass heavy, a lot of passing, a lot of moving, and it's a way that sort of broke open the game from being, I guess, a little stodgy and rigid to being more fluid and spontaneous. And you have players, defenders find themselves far up the pitch, contributing on offense, and that happens more in total football. And Cruyff was not only good at playing, but he was good at explaining his tactics and his philosophy. And so much of the way the game is played today is because of him. And as I said, before him, other teams that played with similar fluidity. But if you're, anyone who's a big soccer fan will have lots to say about Cruyff and his influence and whatnot.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with Nick Green. The book is How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius, and we'll have more following this. Thanks for listening to Access U Time. Tom Williams. We're talking with Nick Green. His latest book is out and available now. It's called How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius. Very well timed. The World Cup is coming to North America this time around. Canada, U.S., and Mexico jointly hosting. That's where I want to go next. The worldwide impact. No other sport can produce the worldwide fervor that the soccer can. One example, you have this in the book, and I remember this scene. Argentina against France, right? The last World Cup.
Yes.
The last penalty kick, right? Gonzalo Montiel. And there's previous to that action, there's a single cyclist cycling through Buenos Aires. And I guess everybody else watching the game, right?
Yeah, it's a cyclist who has he must be a GoPro strapped to his helmet. It's this great video, and he's cycling through Buenos Aires, and it sounds like you've spent time in Argentina, and these huge avenues they have there, which are always jam-packed with traffic, and it looks as if it looks like something out of a zombie movie. It's completely empty. There's no one in the streets, and he's biking, and you can hear some pops and some screams from far off and gasps and whatnot, and you can tell the moment Montiel's kick goes in because everything erupts and you hear the sound first, and then you could just see a sea of humanity sort of flood the streets, and he's biking, and all of a sudden his free lane gets clogged, and it's just a sea of humanity, and he's stopped, and it's a standstill, and everyone's celebrating and delirious. And you just think, what else could have ever done this? I don't think anything but soccer.
Yeah, certainly true. To contrast that, you write that somewhere in the 19th century, some people were concerned that soccer was waning in popularity. There was a book, Appreciation of Football, and the fellow uses at least one. I think he's a musicologist, maybe. So
Yes.
he's comparing the players to instrumentalists.
Yes, this was, even in England, there was a worry that soccer was sort of on its, not necessarily its last legs, but throughout its history. In the beginning, the very beginning, when it split with rugby was more popular. Soccer was sort of the I don't want to say redheaded stepchild of the two, but it was not something that people took seriously. The upper classes didn't like playing it, didn't like watching it. Eventually, obviously, that changed. And then in the 40s and 50s, the attendance was down. There's lots of factors to because to contribute to it. But basically, this the head of the FA at the time and a future president of FIFA, he asked someone he knew, a musicologist who loved soccer, and basically said, hey, the game is perceived as being for jocks and I guess the lower classes, you could say at the time. Can you write some stuff that would help other people appreciate it and sort of highlight the beauty of the game. And so I thought it was interesting, less for his actual content, which is very fun, who he thinks is a the bass, who's a soprano on the field, that kind of thing. But just for the fact that nothing's guaranteed. This game that we think again is, as I said, is ubiquitous and the world's game and the most popular. It's has a shorter history than we imagine and a more tumultuous history. And there's parts as recently as 70, 60 years ago, where people at the very highest levels of the game who were in charge of being its stewards were scared that the game was fading away and nothing is permanent. And even soccer has its struggles. But soccer has always rebounded and has always sort of, in recent history, gained its foothold as the world's game. And I think it's worth reminding yourself that that's not guaranteed. Who knows what will happen with the game? But I'm still enjoying the ride.
Just a couple minutes left here. What's your top takeaway, having spent this time with all these experts and thinking about soccer?
Gosh, my top takeaway is, I guess, just that this is an imperfect game, and I think it's in those imperfections that we can gain the most enjoyment from. That this is not a game that rapidly responds to viewer complaints and viewer criticisms. And that when it does, it doesn't always get them right. Look at VAR, video assistant review, which was introduced in the last 10 years or so. I think 2017, 2018 in an international competition. But it's something it's reviled now, because it was seen to be a quick fix for the problem of things like diving and accurate refereeing. That it's not easy to use modern fixes and modern technology and modern responses to basically remedy any problems with this ancient game, and that there's a lot of value in loving it as is and for its imperfections and trusting the players and the coaches to, I don't know, in their own ways, get it right.
Well, a good place to end the program. We're at the end of our time. We've been talking with Nick Green. And Nick Green, the latest book, full title, How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius, What Architects, Stunt Women, Paleoanthropologists, and Computer Scientists Reveal About the World's Game. Nick Green, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.